You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello and good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming for the Library Foundation. The Library Foundation provides vital support, which is essential in keeping the Los Angeles Public Library active and engaged in our community. I've curated a series over the last year that focuses on power and how it affects our lives. Power comes in many forms, as we know, government, money, class. Sometimes it comes in forms we can't bear to look at, and we need to in order to understand ourselves and our world. Today, I am honored and humbled to bring this book and these two speakers to our program. We're Better Than This, by the late Congressman Elijah Cummings, is the story of our modern day democracy and the threats that we all face. It's also the story of one of the most inspirational and admirable politicians of our time, a civil rights champion. As soon as Congressman Elijah Cummings stepped onto the House floor, he fought to empower and uplift others, always focusing on those less fortunate. He fought, regardless of the party, for democracy and the power for each individual to have rights, the right to vote, and the right to live free in a country he believed in. Today, we welcome writer Jim Dale, who worked with Congressman Cummings to chronicle his extraordinary life. All the way through his final days. We also welcome Congressman Cummings' wife, Dr. Maya Rockymore Cummings, who wrote the book's final chapter, giving us a personal look at his messages to all of us about the importance of our democracy and its fragility. She writes, quote, "He worked until his last breath because he believed our democracy was the highest and best expression of our collective humanity, and that our nation's diversity was our promise, not our problem." Jim Dale is the author and collaborator whose works have included The Power of Nice with Ron Shapiro and also Just Show Up with Hall of Fame baseball player Cal Ripken Jr. Dr. Maya Rockymore Cummings is an accomplished public speaker, author, and strategist on a mission to drive society toward inclusion through innovative public policy and social change. Initiatives both in government, nonprofit, and private sectors. She's appeared on CBS, CNN, MSNBC, and her writings have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Washington Post. She's a former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party and has been a candidate for Maryland governor and for the US Congress. Please join me in welcoming Jim Dale and Maya Cummings. Thank you both so much for being here. I look forward to your conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jessica, we thank you. We appreciate the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and the Aloud program for hosting this book talk today. And Jessica, I appreciate your leadership. The fact that you have been focused on power and certainly your Dear America initiative certainly, I think, points to the fact that, you know, we have a special form of government here in the United States of America. And Elijah always said that if we're not careful, we will lose it. I think it's appropriate that today was the opening day of the impeachment trial, the second impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump. And so certainly I think that Americans are really thinking carefully about what our democracy and our Constitution means. And I think that this conversation that we're having tonight is absolutely going to be appropriate for the times that we're in. That being said, let me just give you a little background on the creation of this book. Elijah and I got married in 2008, but we've known each other since, you know, for over 20 years. And, you know, after we got married, you know, I've heard so many of the stories that were actually written up in the book. And I was just like, you know, Elijah, you really need to share more about your story. You need to write a book. And so, you know, we went through all kinds of, you know, explorations to figure out how to get this book written. And then by happenstance, circumstance, you know, certainly call it a fortuitous, you know, circumstances, some people call it God. You know, I went out to lunch with a friend one day and I was talking about, you know, I need to find a collaborator to work with Elijah on his book. And actually, I didn't even know the word collaborator at the time. I was saying ghostwriter. And she says, I have a friend, and that is what he specializes in. And I said, you're kidding. She said, no. I said, will you introduce me? She said, yes. So I met with Jim Dale. And then, you know, within a short order, I introduced Jim to Elijah, and he will take it from there. But let me just say this. The resulting book has been, I think, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful outcome of that collaboration. The book recently received 2 nominations for the NAACP Image Award in their literary categories. And everybody that I know who knows Elijah, who's read it, says that when they read the book, they can hear Elijah speaking to them. Because they know his cadence, they know the way he says things. And so, you know, I think that that is a testament to the skill and the talent that James Dale, Jim, actually has, that this is actually his ministry, something that he does and does incredibly well. And with that, I'd love to turn it over to Jim Dale.
Thank you very much, Maya. And as Maya said, we met and she was the matchmaker, and I met with Elijah a couple of times, and very quickly it became apparent that he was ready to do the book, and he was ready to put the time in to do the book. And we began to discuss how we would create his story as an interweaving of these formative stories from his life and growing up and his childhood, along with what was going on in the world at that time, the real-time events that were incredibly important and in many cases sort of unprecedented. And he had just taken over as the chair of the oversight committee. And so it was a really critical time. But as I said, we developed this idea, this fabric, interwoven fabric of past informing present. And as Maya said, yes, I have done other collaborations like this, but I've been writing books like this one, co-authoring with someone to help tell our story for almost 25 years. But I'm going to say that personally, this book and this project, this particular collaboration was without question the most meaningful and indelible experience of my writing life. I just have never had anything quite like it. And I'll take you back to that process a little bit. And at the early in it, we would have these sessions and he would tell stories and then I would ask a lot of questions. But early on, I said to Elijah, I'm going to ask you maybe an unfair question. Is there one story in your past that perhaps rises above the rest that would stand out as the most formative in your life? Without hesitation, he recounted the following experience, and I'm going to read an excerpt from that story. When I was no more than 11 years old, my life was forever altered. I certainly didn't realize it at the time. I knew something important was happening, but it took a long while before the impact really hit me. We had a neighborhood community playground center where the kids would gather in the summer with a small wading pool and some recreation counselors to watch over us. Our little wading pool was no more than a few feet across and very shallow, maybe up to your knees, and filled with kids side by side. You had to take turns a half hour at a time. And after the third group, the water was pretty dirty, but that was the only way we had to get cool on a hot day. One day in late August, a lady came and asked us kids, how would you like to go to a real swimming pool? With a diving board, an Olympic sized pool. Well, we all thought that was great, but how was that going to happen? She said there was a pool like that only a few blocks away from where we were in Riverside Park, and that we deserved to go there. And she was going to take us. She said, quote, you can swim to your heart's delight. Those were her words almost 50 years ago, to your heart's delight. Her name was Juanita Jackson Mitchell. And to us, she was just this nice lady who was going to take us to a real swimming pool. We didn't realize until later that she was a civil rights pioneer from a family of civil rights pioneers. The first African-American woman to practice law in Maryland. Juanita Jackson Mitchell's mother was the inspirational Dr. Lily Jackson, who descended from a signer of the Declaration of Independence, but still had to attend the segregated colored high school. She rose to the president of the Baltimore branch of the NAACP, became an early leader in nonviolent protest, and was known as the Mother of Freedom. Her daughter, Juanita, was married to Clarence Mitchell, Jr., a national leader in civil rights and lobbyist for the NAACP, and they were parents of two state senators. Civil rights was practically the family business. What Mrs. Mitchell did not tell us that day about the pool she was taking us to was that it was totally segregated, no Blacks allowed. She and her colleagues at the rec center, Jim Smith and Walter Black, were leading us on an integration march. There we were, a band of little kids walking down the streets of Baltimore from a Black neighborhood into a white neighborhood, only a few blocks from each other, but worlds apart. Day after day, Juanita and Jim and Walter led about 30 of us, walking 10 or 15 blocks, while an angry mob, not of other kids, but grown white adults, yelled names at us, told us to go home, and threw rocks and bricks at little kids. One of those rocks struck me in the forehead and caused a scar that I carry to this day. The police watched and the newspapers took pictures and ran stories, but nobody stopped those angry residents, and nobody stopped us. We kids would swim in the Riverside Park pool each day and then leave with quote unquote neighbors yelling racial epithets and throwing debris in bottles and white kids pushing Black kids in the pool. I call them neighbors ironically. Yes, we all lived within a few blocks of each other, but they were hardly neighborly. They were the opposite, people trying to keep us out of their neighborhood. Tensions were high. After taking Sunday off, they let us all back on Monday, Labor Day. That day, someone called Walter's associate, Lyle Roberts, a nigger, the hostility escalating. About that time, the Riverside Park citizens, clinging to their segregated white enclave, must have realized that we were all going to just keep coming back because they stopped coming to their doorways and out into the streets and shouting and throwing rocks. Just as Juanita Mitchell promised, we all got to go to a real pool. And as she said, we swam to our heart's delight. Even as little children, we had a sense of victory and fear. We'd gone off to play every day, but we ended up making history. That was in the early 1960s, and old rules and practices and even prejudices began slowly, steadily to change. Baltimore stayed largely segregated for the next 10 years, but it was the beginning. The root of what would evolve into a massive upheaval in social norms, real change. For me, that was the beginning of wanting to become somebody who could make things change. I saw that Mitchell and the other people who made integration happen were lawyers. So I wanted to be a lawyer. These lawyers were young men and women who had the courage to walk up the streets and have people yell at them and be unafraid, to have little kids following them, trusting, believing them to make change happen. I wasn't sure what a lawyer was, what their job was, but I saw what they could accomplish. My God, what a powerful force that could be. Change. Little Black children getting what only white children had, because we were, after all just kids. No matter what color, who wanted the same chances in life, the chance to swim in a pool, the chance to go to a good school or live in a nice neighborhood or see a better world. I wanted to be part of that change. And I've endeavored to do so ever since. I've pursued it ever since. As for progress in achieving change, here's a fitting postscript. 30 years later, a man came up to me and identified himself as one of those in the angry mob. Then he told me he was sorry. What's the right response to justice acknowledged but so long delayed? I did not applaud his admission, nor did I spurn it. I said, apology accepted. And that particular response was very indicative of Elijah Cummings recognizing that you take the victory you get, you don't applaud it, but you take it and move on to the next. Maya, I'd like to give it back to you.
Thank you, Jim. Indeed, that was a very formative event in his young life. And we know that it so influenced him that he, of course, became one of the first cohorts of African-American children to go on to integrate Baltimore City public schools. He graduated from one of its prestigious high schools. It's called City College here in Baltimore City. And then went to Howard University, where he was a student body president. He also, of course, was Phi Beta Kappa. And then, of course, he went to law school at the University of Maryland, where he was one of the first cohorts of African-American students to attend that law school. Now, let me just remind everyone that Thurgood Marshall had applied to go to that school, but was rejected because he was African-American. So only a few short years before Elijah gained entry to the University of Maryland. He graduated in 3 years, passed the bar on the first time, was working in the community as a small owner of a law firm, helping people. And then within short order, a woman named Lena K. Lee decided that, she looked around and she was going to retire from her perch as one of the first African-American women lawyers to actually serve in the Maryland State Delegation, House of Delegates. And she was looking for a female lawyer to replace her. And she called Elijah and said, "I was looking for a female lawyer to replace me." And he said, "I'll help you find one." She said, "Nope, you'll do." So she basically took him under her wing and supported him, really kind of helped fundraise for him. And then he entered politics, going on to become the first African-American speaker pro tem of the Maryland House of Delegates before being elected to Congress. Where he basically rose, became a Congressional Black Caucus chair, and then the chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, one of the most powerful seats in the Congress. And at his death, he was actually responsible for investigating everything happening in the Trump administration. He was essentially the lead prosecutor for the nation in terms of the Congress. And so I say all that to say that, the question I always get when I talk to people about Elijah is that how could someone who, was born as an outsider within this country, literally being persecuted for his skin color, having to attend separate and unequal schools, having to live in segregated neighborhoods, how does someone who had been so mistreated by this nation in his youth, and that of course of his ancestors and his parents and relatives, and how could somebody like that go on to become one of the leading defenders of our democracy? How is that possible? Now I'm going to put that question in your minds. I want to let everyone know that we will welcome all of your questions in the chat. Just as soon as you think of them, go ahead and place them in the chat. Because right now what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a passage, a short passage from the book, and then we're going to actually go to Q&A. And so with that, here I go. After the Democrats regained the majority in the midterms, Elijah was finally the chairman of the Committee on Oversight and Reform. Elijah was in a position to lead investigations and to set the agenda for hearings. But he was sober about the realities of the threats he and his committee would face from the Trump administration and congressional Republicans. Despite his pain, he threw himself into his work. Then in late summer, just before his speech at the National Press Club, he took yet another bad turn and was readmitted to Johns Hopkins. The underlying suspicion was that his cancer had come back. Elijah was weaker than I'd seen him in years. A day before he was to give the speech, I asked if he still intended to do it. And he said, "Maya, I'll be there if I have to crawl." Elijah was so drained that when his aides maneuvered him to the podium, pale and unsteady, I thought he might drop. Then he looked at the crowd, four or five times the size of what had been expected, before his investigations into the administration, before the shootings in Dayton and El Paso, and before Trump's Twitter attack on Baltimore and Elijah. He looked at the crowd and you could see him become energized. He exhorted the audience to listen, and more important, to take action. He was passionate as only Elijah Cummings could be. The gathering of usually callous Washington media cheered and gave him a standing ovation. Exhausted and barely able to keep going, he went straight back to the hospital. During the next few weeks, he managed to continue vital work. He was on the phone with Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, Jerry Nadler, and his staff. He read testimony. He reviewed the impeachment updates. He signed subpoenas so many times, I said, "Elijah, that's enough for today." "Okay, I'll stop soon," he'd say. Doctors at Hopkins and NIH monitored his cancer. It was obviously recurring. The question was, could they do anything to slow it down or limit it? Earlier in December of 2018, I had run for and won the job of chair of the Maryland Democratic Party, a demanding position. I tried to do what Elijah would do it all, somehow fulfill my obligations to the job while giving Elijah full-time care. But as it became increasingly clear, we were nearing the end. So I stopped doing the work of the Maryland Democratic Party to be with Elijah around the clock. We all did everything we could. There became, I think the best word is, an inevitability to it. He knew, and I suspected, we were coming to the end. It was coming as if you could see it like a train approaching in the distance. When you're not sure how far away it is, but you know it's steadily coming towards you. That's when he began to talk differently. He would say he was tired, no matter how much rest he got, just tired all the time. He complained of constant pain. It was clearly physical, but it was also emotional and spiritual. The inner Elijah was burning out. We talked about the past, what Elijah had done, and about the future and all that remained to be done, but we did not use the word death. We just knew. As if sped by his passing, events moved even faster in the days just after Elijah's death. On December 18, 2019, Speaker Nancy Pelosi banged the gavel and announced that the House of Representatives voted 230 to 197, strictly along party lines, to impeach Donald J. Trump, the third president in the history of the United States to face impeachment charges. That evening, during her press conference, she spoke about Elijah. She honored him as a key force in the inquiry, our North Star. And she quoted him, quote, "When the history books are written about this tumultuous era, I want them to show that I was among those in the House of Representatives who stood up to lawlessness and tyranny." She added, quote, "He also said somewhat presciently, when we're dancing with angels, the question will be, what did you do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? We did all we could, Elijah. We passed the two articles of impeachment. The president is impeached." As I often told people in the days after Elijah's death, Elijah's death wasn't just my loss. It was our loss as a nation. And we all have the responsibility to move his legacy forward. Because we know that with every transgression, every disregard for the Constitution, every attempt to act above the law, every denial of truth, our democracy is endangered. That's why in the months and years ahead, we must continue to hear Elijah's voice. We're better than this. We're better than this. Yes, we are. We must be. Now, that came from my last chapter of the book, but you know, since that time, since I wrote the book, there have been so many things that have happened. Of course, Elijah's words were prescient. We've lived through some historic moments, from the first impeachment charges to the acquittal, to the COVID pandemic, the botched response to the COVID pandemic, the ugly presidential campaign that was thankfully won by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, you know, to the claims, the lies, the big lie of Trump and his loyalists about him winning the election instead, to his unfounded and outrageous lawsuits, trying to press that claim in the courts, and certainly, of course, Republicans actually falling in line behind, the president, supporting the president's election lies, even people like Bill Barr and Chris Christie finally turning their backs on it and rejecting the fraud claims. But you know, we know that over 100 members of Congress actually voted to overthrow the Electoral College votes for Biden and Harris so that Trump could be installed by his own VP. You know, and of course we know today we're talking about the president inciting violence by encouraging his supporters to march to the US Capitol and fight. And it was an insurrection against democracy. So, you know, the fact of the matter is I'm getting a lot of questions now. What would have Elijah thought? What would he have done? So, you know, none of this would have been a surprise to Elijah, because Elijah believed strongly that not only was Donald J. Trump unfit for the position, but he knew there were two other things. One is he felt that if Donald J. Trump got a second term in office, he would tear our democracy apart brick by brick. He knew that Donald Trump had no respect for the Constitution, for our democratic norms, for our democracy itself. In fact, he thought that you know, Donald Trump was acting as an enemy of the state. And the other thing that he was very concerned about, now remember, Elijah was in charge of all of the investigations into the Trump administration. He saw up close and personal what happened to those kids and families at the border, at the US southern border. And he always believed that Donald Trump and his administration had a streak of cruelty in them that he thought that would be unleashed in a second term. So he spent the last year of his life writing this book for two reasons. One was to, of course, tell young people that, you know, he faced a lot of obstacles in his life, and he wanted to encourage them that they could overcome it. If they just press forward, they could reach their dreams. But the second was to warn the American public about Donald J. Trump and the threat that he represented to our democracy and our humanity. So, you know, with that, you know, he would have, of course, been devastated to see what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. But his refrain would have always been, we're better than this. We are better than this. And this book, We Are Better Than This, gives his reasons why. So, you know, with that, you know, I'm just thankful, and Elijah would have been thankful that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won. I think that, you know, we have received a reprieve in this country. But one thing that we have to do is we have to recognize that what we have is precious, and that we have to fight not only to make it better, but to make sure that it remains intact for our children and their children's children. So with that, I think that we're ready for a conversation.
Jessica, are you joining us? I am joining you. Hi, guys. How are you? I wanted to bring up some of the questions that people have been asking. And also thank you for that. I would agree that we learned the fragility of our democracy, and we also learned about its strength. So I think you're absolutely right. And I'm at the mercy of all those who can help us build and make us a better country. So I wanted to ask you, these questions were coming in. One of them said, you know, what you covered a bit, how would Congressman Cummings react to what is happening on the floor today with this second impeachment trial? And, you know, what would have been his reaction to this?
So he would have exhorted everyone to take this seriously. He would have begged, frankly, his Republican colleagues on the Senate side to absolutely keep an open mind and to, you know, frankly, put country before party. You know, he was known for his bipartisanship and had, you know, friends on the Republican side as well as on the Democratic side. And so, you know, I think he was appalled that the Republicans, who, by the way, have always claimed to be the greatest patriots in this country. You know, when I worked on Capitol Hill, they were walking around with little pocket constitutions in their pockets, claiming that they were the biggest defenders of our Constitution. And we've seen all of that fall by the wayside in the Trump administration. And so Elijah would have been, I think, deeply concerned, but gratified that that the Senate decided to actually move forward by declaring, of course, the second impeachment trial constitutional. He would have been watching this carefully. And of course, he would have been waiting anxiously for the final vote.
What do you feel this book, what at this moment, how can this book guide us? What does he say in the book that you feel really could guide the time that's unraveling right before us right now?
Jim?
Well, I think Maya mentioned a very important part, and it's the long picture, and we'll talk about the immediate and the long term. He said, Elijah said on numerous occasions, the very beginning, I said, what do you want this book to be? And remember, at that point, the country was in a lot of trouble, but nothing close to where we ended up not too long after that. He said, I want to show people what's possible. I want to show young people what's possible, particularly disadvantaged people, particularly people who may not be hopeful, particularly people who may be of color, people who don't necessarily see what's possible. He said, I want to show them what's possible. And he would, say, what I accomplished, what others have accomplished, I want them to see that. And young, in particular, young people. And that was, that was one of those moments where I thought, well, politicians we don't often think of as being quite that selfless, because he was, he was talking about just making young people feel good about themselves. There are no votes in that, and getting a 14-year-old to feel good. But that was very, very important to him. And he never sort of forgot how he had come through, what he had come through. So that's sort of the bigger, longer arc. And in the more immediate, he expressed over and over, I've said to him on some occasions, we'd be talking for a long time and I'd get sort of down at the end of the conversation. And I'd say, because this is after things were getting pretty bad. And I say, Elijah, I know you're a great believer in democracy and what it can do. Are you optimistic or pessimistic at this point? And he would, as he often did, take a deep breath, think about it. And he would say something like, I'm very, very pessimistic at this moment. I am optimistic long-term, but he said, but Jim, it will be very rough to get there. Very rough. And much later on, he said, I don't know if I'll see it. But earlier, it was just this sort of, we were in moments of deep, deep pessimism, but he had this faith, belief that we would get through it in a very rocky way. Well, that this book recounts that and leaves you with that sort of hope. If you seize the opportunity, he must have said, go vote to me 100,000 times, that people have to,
go vote. Wasn't that the last thing that his mother said to him?
Yeah.
It was, wasn't it on her deathbed? She said, just make sure that everyone votes. Wasn't that?
They don't take away that. Yeah.
Not to take the vote away.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But to have that kind of, I just think that, to go through a very, very difficult lifetime, then to be faced with this in the final chapter, and then still say, in the long run, I am optimistic. He had his belief in the country and in the democracy, even if it was down to one vote on one side, that it was going to be 51-49, he believed it. And so I would sometimes, instead of being depressed, I'd say to my wife, I think we're going to be okay, but it's going to be hard to get there.
I watched quite a few clips of him before you both came, and just to prepare. And I was so struck by the fact, yes, there's no partisan, he wasn't a partisan man. He was a man who really was so ethical and so devoted to democracy and to really just championing, freedoms. And so I guess here's another question I think is interesting. How would he have approached this growing partisanship in this country? And how can we heal this rift? by, you know, deny a kind of humanity to their citizens. I mean, how did he look at that? I can ask both of you. I'll go to Maya first.
Yeah.
But and both of you, because you, I'm sure you talked about this so much.
But you saw it every day at the end of the day when he come home.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, of course, you know, this level of partisanship that we have is just, it was draining for him, you know, but he tried to actually fight through it by, you know, trying to be an honest broker, by establishing real personal relationships with people across the aisle. You saw it through his efforts to try to, you know, connect with Donald Trump. You know, when Donald Trump was first elected, Elijah, of course, decided to go to the inauguration. We went to the luncheon that usually happens right after the inauguration, and Elijah made a connection with Donald Trump and became the first Democrat to actually meet with Donald Trump. And so that just shows you that Elijah has always been about, you know, reaching out and trying to establish some kind of real connection. He's done it with other Republicans, you know, with varying levels of success. But he thought that, you know, if people weren't operating through the lens of partisanship, if they saw each other on the level of their common humanity, then when it came to the big issues, the issues facing our country, that they would be able to rise above the partisan warfare and be able to, and Elijah always said, it's bigger than you, it's bigger than me, it's bigger than us. We need to be thinking about the big picture. And so, you know, I think that, you know, he was deeply concerned about, you know, what I call asymmetrical political warfare, which is happening in this country as we speak. But, you know, I think that he always thought that, you know, relationships could actually help to drive a different outcome.
Maya referenced that the very first meeting that he had with Trump, with President Trump, and he was telling it to me, and he said, he took me through the story, and he said, I'm going to try to tell it to you the way I felt as it progressed. He said, I went in and, you know, I was skeptical and so on. He said, but, you know, he started talking, Trump started talking. And he said, you know, he can be kind of relaxed. And he said, it was like talking to a guy. He said, I said to myself, you know, this is like talking to a guy on the street. And you sort of say, he's telling me what he thinks and I'm telling him what I think. And we're getting along. We're not just agreeing with each other, but, you know, it's sort of an honest exchange. And he said, I felt like, he kept saying, like a guy on the street that you, and he said, and you know, right away, this guy giving it to me straight. And at first I thought, well, maybe he is, and maybe I'll disagree with him, but he's giving it to me straight. And he said, as the conversation progressed, not only over the next 15, 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but over the follow-up conversation, he said, he wasn't a guy on the street. He was a guy who was lying to me. And he said he heard that, got that first lie, and realized it was not a standalone lie. So he went into it with this, I want to say naivete, but with a street smart feeling, I can judge people. And I would say, Maya, you know this, I would say probably, you know, 9 out of 10 times was a very good judge of people. And he thought he saw Trump one way. Very shortly after that, he was a good judge. He saw him for exactly what he was, but he gave him that shot. He gave him a chance.
And he gave him a chance because he felt that he owed it to his constituents and to the people of America to do whatever was possible to see if they could forge the divide in order to find common ground to help the American people. And he was very much focused on, you know, all of the people who have been hurt by, you know, dramatically rising prescription drug costs. And he thought that this is something that Donald Trump should want to do something about. And this is something that where we can probably find common ground around, something that will help the American people. He was that devoted and dedicated to doing something to help the American people.
And he had, as you know, he had some very good friends who, with whom he shared no political common ground, but they were friends then. Because he felt that they could connect, and on some level, on some issues, some places, they found a place to get together. And so today, what would he be saying? I think he'd probably be very surprised in the short space of 2 or 3 years at how much further they could be driven apart from each other.
Right. This is, I'm going to ask one more question that's sort of around what we're discussing. I mean, this sort of growing, how did he feel? I mean, that the idea of voting, the idea that it was so important for him, that the idea of democracy being important, the idea that his mother, you know, before she passed away, saying that. And here, you know, it seems that there is a growing distrust in both government and the electoral system in general. And I'm wondering, I mean, and as this person is, would he have advised, what would he have advised to do, or what did he say to both of you that would maybe regain people's trust in our electoral system? Was there ever a sense that he discussed that with you, Maya, or Jim?
So he was very disappointed that the Voting Rights Act had been gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. And he felt that was a huge mistake on the part of the Supreme Court, because he knew that there continued to be challenges to the rights to vote, particularly of African Americans and other people of color in this country. And so, you know, he was deeply concerned about that. And he was also concerned, I think he would have been concerned, about the role that the right-wing media played in terms of perpetuating the lies in this election cycle and beyond. Because, you know, this distrust doesn't just happen in a vacuum. There is a forum for it. And that forum has often taken place, you know, certainly in media outlets that have been so intent on, I don't know, you know, connecting with the Republican base and with Donald Trump, that they have, I think, foregone the truth to their own detriment. We now know that, of course, there is a voting company, a voting machine company that's suing Fox News for $2 billion. For the lies that it allowed to actually happen on their platform following the election. So, you know, we owe it to the American people, of course, to be truthful. And he was shocked that the president of the United States was a serial liar. But, you know, we also owe it to the American people to make sure that the media companies that we give, you know, all kinds of breaks and platforms to through our legal system, you know, do what's right by the American people. And I'm just going to add a third one. And that is that we have not done enough to provide quality civic education in our schools. And I do think that it's important that we ratchet that up, relook at how we can actually provide quality civic education across this country. I think it's the duty that we owe to our children so that they can actually be informed and the sophisticated participants in our democracy.
We often say that we all grew up with that, and now it's really not—it's not taught, and it was sort of second nature. I'm going to add one other thing that is a—it's a one at a time process. But Elijah had a great deal of empathy, and we take that for granted sometimes. We don't see enough empathy in politicians. You know, we see that sometimes they'll say the right words. But one of the things that struck me, a little tiny moment, we were talking about, he was going to do the hearing where he had Michael Cohen, was going to talk about his dealings with the president. And apart from all the things he was going to talk about, all the terrible things that he had witnessed or helped accomplish, Elijah said, you know, I feel for that guy. Well, at that time, nobody felt for that guy. Obviously, Trump no longer felt for that guy. And people on the other side were saying, well, he's not exactly the lawyer you want to hire. He's a shady guy. I went into that. I said, well, wait a minute. What do you mean? I feel for that guy. He said, I practice law in a small practice on the street with, you know, local people. He said, I saw people come in who had gone wrong. And then they finally, something would just crack and they'd say, they'd sort of realize it had gone wrong. He said they didn't become great people overnight. They didn't somehow transform into, you know, from devil to angel, but they would say, you know, they'd realize what happened. He said, and I feel like Michael Cohen is, he said, he's not going to turn into a great guy. He said, but he's a guy who's hurting. Well, you know, who says that? Where do we hear that today? It's so uncommon. And that is a sort of one at a time way to try to, you know, you ask the question, it's, I'm not giving you a very practical answer in terms of how do we win people back one at a time, but it is kind of how it goes. It is, in my own way, I think that's what we saw in this election.
I agree.
A few people who said, no, maybe I shouldn't have done what I did last time. I'm going to do it a little differently this time.
It's interesting you brought up the Cohen hearing because his empathy was so deep. I mean, because I just listened to that today, that he said, you know, he said, I understand your situation. I feel for you and your family. I mean, he was able to go that extra mile, which I thought, you know, this is about everyone being a human being. How do we communicate? How do we get along? So I've got just a couple more questions. They're different. I think I'll direct them to you, Maya, and then you can pivot to Jim if you'd like. And then we'll wrap it up after these two. The question I'm curious to see what you think would be, how would Elijah give young activists who want to follow in his footsteps? What advice would he give them?
Great question.
Yeah, so he would have said, don't ever let anyone define you, which was a piece of advice that he got from his own mother. But he also often exhorted young people to understand that, you know, their peers and, you know, perhaps family and, you know, people they don't even know are going to try to put them in a box over their lifetime. But they have to be true to themselves. They have to be true to their passion, their hearts, and their vision for their own lives. And so, don't ever let anybody define you was one of his, you know, incredible pieces of advice that he always exhorted young people to follow. He also wanted to encourage them. He had this formula, pain, passion, purpose. And so he always knew that young people were trying to still find what their purpose in life was. And Elijah would tell them, listen, you know, what I have found from my experience and looking at the experiences of others is that usually whatever happens in your own life that brings you a deep pain that you want to seek resolution to usually leads you to your passion, which then leads you to your purpose. And so he viewed that as a formula for that he would tell people, young people, you know, to really look at, if you're looking for your purpose, just look for where you're most passionate, which is where probably your deepest pain lies. So that was another thing. And of course, you know, he cared deeply about young people and, you know, often said our children are the living messengers we send to a future that we will never see. And so, you know, he did a lot of work around youth development, and it was something that he was deeply passionate about. And I think that's because, you know, in his youth, they didn't have a lot of opportunities. And so with that, you know, you want to add anything, Jim?
No, I think that, well, I did think of one thing that he embraced the squad and who are, in their own ways, activists as well, certainly outspoken young voices. And he didn't say, like, I'm an old guy who's been around Congress all this time, and I don't need those people. He actually said he went to Nancy Pelosi and said, in populating his committee, said, give me the young ones. So again, he was encouraging that kind of voice, encouraging that statement, and don't let someone else define you.
Actually, let me just add on to that, because we had conversations at home. The other committee chairs didn't want AOC. They didn't want Ayanna Pressley. They didn't want Rashida Tlaib. And Elijah went to Nancy Pelosi and said, give them to me. And so, you know, the fact of the matter is that he viewed their energy, their passion as an asset. And he even said, you know, he felt like he could mentor them but he felt that he had a lot to learn from them as well. And so, you know, I think that, you know, the fact that he dedicated a significant section of his book in the Michael Cohen hearings to actually applauding them and their leadership, I think, you know, says a lot. In fact, Willie Geist on Morning Joe asked me, you know, who did Elijah think would be, did he say that anybody was going to be the next leader? You know, who did he appoint, so to speak? And, you know, he didn't mention really anybody else in those terms except the squad. And so I think that, you know, we all have to be respectful of certainly the way that he described their bravery and their leadership and expect even greater things from them in the future.
I could ask you, there are more and more questions. I could go on and on. I'm going to just stop with one question, and I'm going to ask you both, because you know, but I'm going to first ask Maya, or maybe I'll ask Jim, and then Maya, you will end with you. What did Elijah see as his legacy? What did he want to be remembered for most? I think by asking that question, we will keep the memory is very much alive, but we can leave on that note. So I'd love to find out first from you and then from Maya, the thoughts.
Well, again, another one of his mantras was be effective and efficient. And
I'm writing all these down, by the way. Passion and pain and that one as well.
There were three or four of these things, and he would, but effective and efficient. When he first said that one, I thought, well, gee, that's so sort of cold. I said, well, you know, what do you mean by that? And he was, you know, on some days I wanted to add to it impatient. Because when he wanted to get something done, he wanted to get it done. And if it wasn't going to get done, he wanted to move on. And he'd say, get something done, accomplish something, get what you can get. So it was very pragmatic. So if you want, you know, idealistically 100% of this, and it becomes apparent you're going to get 65% of this and not more, he might fight a little harder and get it up to 68, 69, 70%, and then say, okay, we're moving on. We're going to the next thing. I'm not going to get bogged down here. That effective and efficient would be with people around him would be, let's get something done. Let's not argue all day. I think that in some ways was his life as a kid. I want to get from here to there, and I want to get from there to there. I want to get, you know, we could tell the whole story of his education and how he overcame those obstacles and then go on to become a great student, go on to Howard, go on to law school, get it done, move on. It was sort of relentless progress.
I would say that it's the Elijah Cummings Youth Program. And it's been in operation more than 20 years. Basically identifies young people throughout the Baltimore region from disadvantaged backgrounds. They select a cohort of 20 every year. And those young people are usually rising high school from sophomores to juniors. And they go on a trip to Israel, they go abroad, and then they, you know, get tutoring and support and exposure. And they have had a 100% graduation rate from high school, and they have had 95% of their graduates to actually graduate from college. Now, some of these kids have gone on to very prestigious universities. And some of them have gone on to very prestigious careers. I mean, Victor Blackwell is on CNN. He's a commentator on CNN. You know, you've got some who are now entering and running for office, some who are running organizations, nonprofits. So, you know, I think Elijah was very proud, and he was very dedicated to that program and very proud of the outcome of many of his students.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, that's extraordinary. I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon. To talk about Elijah Cummings is, I what a joy, and what an amazing, amazing man. And to have you both here and to have this book, which he wrote with you, Jim, and with you, Maya, at the end, you finished it. It's an extraordinary thing. So thank you both for being here. I'm honored to have asked you the questions and to have been involved in this program. And I want to thank everybody for joining this afternoon. I want to thank all our members for making this possible. And I want, if you would consider becoming a member, please go to lfla.org/support. And please join us for another program next week on February 18th. It's 5 o'clock Pacific Standard Time with Rosa Brooks discussing her new book, Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. A very interesting, compelling book. And thank you both so much for being here. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you. Take care.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.